the director of the Charleston Museum, right? I mentioned it's our 250th anniversary. We were founded in 1773. It's an incredible honor.
Hey everyone, you're listening to the Lively Charleston Podcast. Our goal with this show is to interact and tell the stories of the amazing people, places, and businesses that make Charleston the best city in the world.
If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to iTunes, Spotify, and YouTube.
And check us out on Instagram and Facebook, where we post content regularly throughout the week.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have a really special and unique guest here today. I'm very excited about this episode. Because we have Mr. Carl Borick, the director of the Charleston Museum, joining us on the Lively Charleston Podcast here to talk about what's going on and tell a little bit about his story. So, Carl, thank you very much for being a guest on our show.
Thank you all for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. So we have a lot to talk about. The Charleston Museum is the oldest museum in the country, which I did not know until you informed me of that in kind of getting to know you a little bit more. That's crazy. So we have a lot to talk about here. But before we get into that, let's talk about you a little bit and get to know you and how you came to be the director of the museum.
Absolutely.
We'll go from there. How's that sound?
Sounds great.
All right. So how long have you been in Charleston?
So I've been in Charleston since 1994.
Okay. And what brought you out here?
My original degree was in accounting. And so I'm a CPA and came here, worked on some clients. I was working in Greenville and had a change in job, decided to come down here, had some clients down here and was exposed to the Charleston area and like everyone else, fell in love with it. So moved here back in 94.
Okay. Okay. So you were an accountant. That's how you paid the bills before you got into the history business.
That's right.
Did you always have an inclination for history or was this something that kind of developed once you got here?
Really from my earliest memories, you know, playing with toy soldiers as a kid, playing Francis Marion in the backyard. I remember in Greenwood, South Carolina. You know, pretty much, you know, my earliest memories were of doing things historical, you know, going to museums with my family, going to historic sites with my family. Yeah, absolutely.
Is that something that came from your parents? Did they impress that upon you?
Well, I sort of probably from my mom. She grew up near Saratoga, New York, where it was a major battle during the Revolutionary War. And I remember her talking about that quite a bit. And my dad was just kind of generally interested. He was a PhD in microbiology. He was just interested in everything, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like he was probably a pretty smart guy himself.
Yes.
Absolutely. So when you were, you know, coming up through middle school, high school, and you had history class, were these typically those are the ones for most kids. Those are tough. They're tough to do. Was it something that you were even interested in at that age?
I think I won the social studies award in like, you know, eighth grade. And so I just always excelled in it. And I think because of the interest in it is why I was, you know, always so so successful in it, yes.
I think that's so neat. I remember for me, at least up through high school, history for me was very painful. And it was just, I don't know, I was a math guy, you know, so I was headed more into the CPA route. So I think it's a unique set of interests that you have to have kind of the analytical brain side of things, right? Where numbers make a lot of sense and, you know, you play with those, but also have an appreciation for history.
Sure.
I think that's probably pretty rare.
Well, and that's why, you know, the position at the museum has been so great for me, right? Because, you know, I have an understanding of our program side of things, the history, what we're doing, what we're presenting to the public, what we're educating people about. But in order to do those things, you have to be able to manage the organization. You have to be able to have the resources, make sure you have the proper amount of resources. And that was one of the things that our board of trustees and our former director saw in me that said, you know, this guy would really, really succeed as the director of the Charleston Museum.
Yeah, because I mean, you're essentially running a business as well, right? And you have budget and you have staff and you have training and you have all these things that you have to manage at the same time, right?
That's true. And you know, people say, "Oh, you're the director of the museum. That must be really a fun job." Well, you have to deal with a lot of budgeting, personnel, you know, fundraising, all the things that allow you to do the educational mission that the Charleston Museum presents. Yes,
absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so. Let's transition into that. So you were, you transitioned from being a CPA, you got a position at the museum. What was that original position?
So I was originally hired as the administrative officer at the museum. So I handled all the, you know, the books, personnel, all that kind of thing. But they realized, you know, pretty early that I had a lot of other ability because in addition to an accounting degree, after I worked in accounting for a couple of years, I also went back and got a master's in history. So, you know, I learned how to research and I learned how to write. And those skills really were very useful once I came to the museum.
Gotcha. Okay. And so that kind of that set you on a path to having more opportunities at the museum.
Correct.
When you were, how was your experience when you first got there?
So, you know, it was basically doing the books of the museum every month, doing the financial statements, you know, working with our auditors on our year end, doing the payroll, doing the accounts payable. So the basics. But as I said, they realized pretty early that I had other skills. And so in 2001, I guess it was, I had the opportunity to actually do an exhibit on the Revolutionary War, and which was highly successful. And then our assistant director retired in 2001, and I was promoted to assistant director. And then when our director retired in 2013, as the board said, this gentleman really, he knows his way around the museum. You know, and one of the things that I've taken personally from that is we generally, you know, all of our, the three of our four management team, the managers that support me at the museum, they were all hired, you know, as lower level staff people and worked their way up. And you know, I think it's always best to hire from within because, you know, people know the organization, they know the people there, they know what the organization is capable of. So, you know, that really was a path for me that I've always been appreciative of. And so I've tried to do that for others as well.
I think that's great. I think that's great. And it makes a ton of sense to your point. Even for someone like you moving into the assistant director and then the director role, you're already very familiar with the financials and the books and with kind of how that part of things works.
Right.
And then so whoever takes that over, you're already speaking the same language.
Sure. And you know, one thing, when people hear the word nonprofit, which the Charleston Museum is a 501c3, they think, oh, you're not trying to make any money. Well, you've got to make money in order to accomplish your mission, according to, you know, and to enable you to do good things for the community.
Yeah, 100%. Well, because obviously you want great staff so you can run a great organization. They need to be able to make a living. And plus, you know, the additional exhibits, you still have to market to get people to come to the museum, right? The same way any other business would. And then to do these new exhibits and these new projects and some of the things that we're going to talk about here, all that stuff costs money.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, I hear you there. So you mentioned putting on an exhibit for the Revolutionary War. That was something that was one of the first big projects you got to take on. What goes into that when you take on that job? You say, okay, I'm in charge of this now, and I'm gonna put this exhibit together. What does that look like from the planning up through the execution and kind of the final product?
Sure. Well, one of the things about the museum, so we've got 2.4 million objects in our collection, and really most all of our exhibits are based around the collections that we have. You know, people will sometimes come to the museum and they're like, well, why don't you cover X? Well, we don't have any historical collections that are related to that topic.
Gotcha.
Right? So we pretty much have to, that's how we design our exhibits, right? So for the Revolutionary War exhibit, we had some great things in the collection. But for the one that I worked on, we also borrowed a number of things from other museums. In fact, we brought some things over from Great Britain exhibited, like the logbooks from British warships who had served here in Charleston Harbor, and some other documents from some muskets from Great Britain. So, you know, if it's a special exhibit like that, when you will, in addition to the collection pieces in the Charleston Museum, we, you know, look for others that we can get on loan. And then the next step is, okay, what's your narrative? Okay, you have these collection pieces. You've got to come up with a story around that. You got to do the research. You got to put those that narrative together, which will ultimately become the exhibit labels. And then, you know, we're very fortunate to have a really talented graphic designer on our staff. And so typically he works with our collections and our exhibit staff to say, okay, how are we going to present these now? I mean, not only how are we going to mount these objects and how are we going to tell the story surrounding them, but, you know, what's going to go up on the walls, what kind of images are we going to use with them. And so it's a pretty extensive process.
Yeah.
And our chief of collections, who oversees our exhibits process, she would tell you know, they're meeting like on a weekly basis just to plan the exhibits that we put on.
Wow. And what does that look like from start to finish, from kind of launching the project to, you know, when it's ready to be seen? What sort of timeline are you looking at?
Generally 3 to 6 months.
Okay.
And in fact, we're already looking at our, you know, exhibit schedule over the next several years. For instance, you mentioned the Revolutionary War. So 2026 is going to be the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, right? It's going to be a huge celebration across the country. our state organization, South Carolina 250, is gearing up for it. And so we're already starting to think about what's going to go into that exhibit. And again, probably like we did in the exhibit back in 2003, we're gonna have to borrow some things from elsewhere to put in the exhibit.
Really? Is that a sore subject when you reach out to Great Britain and say, you know, hey, I know you guys lost this one, but can we borrow some of your memorabilia here for the exhibit?
Most people in the museum field are you know, pretty collegial. So I don't think they have any hard feelings. Let's put it that way.
They're okay with it. It's not like if the Lakers asked the Celtics for the shoes they wore when they lost that one championship.
Right. That'd be a little different. Yeah.
All right. Fair enough. So let's talk about what's the mission for the museum here? What's kind of the overall vision, the mission, you know, what's the museum really hoping to accomplish here?
So our mission is to educate the public about the natural and cultural history of the South Carolina Lowcountry, right? We do that through our exhibits. We do that through our collections, the related programs that we do. We also, preservation, we have two historic houses in addition to the museum. And then also conservation, because we have a wildlife sanctuary on James Island. So really it is just to preserve and Lowcountry cultural and natural history, and also educate folks about them. So.
Very nice. And how many folks do you have that come through the museum in any given week or month or throughout the year?
So this year, we should have about 135,000 visitors.
Wow.
That come to the museum in our historic houses, yes.
Wow.
And in fact, this year will be the best visitation we've had since 2001. And that's been a reflection, I think, of the excitement over the 250th anniversary. Yeah. And it just, you know, it's just a great place to visit. And, you know, a lot of museums nationwide, I just looked at these statistics last week, per the American Alliance of Museums, have not recovered from the pandemic. In fact, only one in three museums, per their numbers, have gotten back to their attendance prior to the pandemic. So we're very fortunate. I mean, best attendance in over 20 years. So we're all very excited about that.
Wow. Wow. That's really cool. Have any of those museums had to shut down and consolidate?
That was the big fear when the pandemic first struck. And, you know, many of the museums were able to take advantage of the federal funding that became available. And if it hadn't, I think a lot of them would have gone under.
Sure.
But that really was fortunate in terms of the museum community.
Yeah. So you talked about one of the questions we like to ask our guests here is just some of their favorite personal and professional achievements. And your personal achievements were reflective around your family, your wife and your boys, and then also that you're an author. You've written two books on the Revolutionary War. What would you like to share about any of those?
Well, as far as, you know, professional accomplishments, to be the director of the Charleston Museum, right? As I mentioned, it's our 250th anniversary. We were founded in 1773. It's an incredible honor, right? And, from my standpoint, it worked out well with the accounting background, with the history background, to be able to do the things I've been able to do and lead, you know, just such a wonderful organization. I've written two books on the Revolutionary War. As I mentioned, since I was a kid, I've been interested in that topic. One on the Siege of Charleston, which was, ended up being the largest defeat of the American forces during the war, but kind of the final chapter of the book talks about how, you know, the British go out in the backcountry of South Carolina and they face all this resistance, and, you know, they thought they'd won it all by taking Charleston, and that turned out not to be the case. And the other one is sort of a follow-up to that, because it's about the prisoners of war that were captured in Charleston and what became of them. And then most recently, and I collaborated with museum staff on this, we did a book on the 250th anniversary of the Charleston Museum. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. How is that what's that book called, by the way?
It's called The Charleston Museum, America's First Museum.
That's the third book.
Yes.
What are the first two called?
First one is A Gallant Defense, The Siege of Charleston, 1780. And the second one is Relieve Us of This Burden, American Prisoners of War in the Revolutionary South.
All right. Well, there you go. And those are available on Amazon?
Amazon or your local library.
All right. So, yep. All right. I'll have to check those out.
Please do.
Something not many people know about you. I thought this was really interesting. You said you're not much of an artist yourself, but you can draw a pretty good great white shark.
I can.
Interesting. Is that the only animal you can draw pretty well.
I could probably draw some other ones, but they wouldn't look as good as the great white.
Really? And how did you just stumble across this great white shark artistry skill that you have?
I had a huge poster on my wall when I was a kid of a great white. And to this day, I will still have nightmares about being in deep water and having a great white around me, but I can still draw them.
You're telling me. Do we have a little anxiety about the ocean? Do we go out and jump out in the water?
I'll swim, but I won't swim deep. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. No desire to go like cage diving or anything?
No.
Nothing like that.
In fact, I get these, post Facebook and Instagram videos that pop up of great whites, and I'm like, man, I can't believe those people do that. One specifically where a woman holds on to the fin of a great white and swims along beside it.
That's insane.
Yeah.
That's insane.
I wouldn't do it.
Some people just have a death wish or, you know, these adrenaline junkies.
Right, yeah.
I do have on my bucket list to go shark diving with great whites at some point. I don't know if that'll actually get checked off, you know, when I'm actually on the boat and he's down there. We'll see. That'll be the moment of truth, but right. It's on the list. Anyways. All right. So you learned how to draw a pretty cool great white shark. It's pretty impressive. I felt like we needed to mention that.
So much so. Let me just say, so much so. When we redid our natural history gallery back in 2017, we worked with a designer, and she was a pretty decent artist herself, and she was impressed with the great white shark. So
really?
About that, yeah.
So, that I mean, that's a real testament.
In fact, she asked to keep the little doodle that I had done. She asked to keep it.
Really? Because you can doodle it any time. Exactly. So, right? Happy to give those away. Yeah. Very nice. Very nice. One of the other things you talked about was hiring and developing your staff at the museum is one of the things you're really proud of. What's that process been like? And, you know, have you had any hurdles along the way of, you know, building this team that you're proud of right now?
There's always hurdles, you know, when it comes to personnel. I mean, it can, when someone comes into an interview, they're going to put on their best face.
Sure.
And
sure.
You don't always, you don't know what the person's really like until they come to work for you. But that's really the advantage of hiring from within, right? Because you hire people, come on board, and they prove themselves.
Yep.
And you know as one of our former board presidents said about me, the cream rises to the top. You'll know pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You know who can be a leader. And the ages list folks, you know, range from late 20s up to, you know, around 50. So I mean it's some people, you know, prove themselves pretty quickly, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's your staff? What's it look like right now? How many people are working with you? What are some of the key roles there?
So we have a 19 full-time staff, and then we have roughly, about 20-some part-time staff. Most of our part-time staff are working at our storehouses. They give tours of our storehouses.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and so as far as roles, you know, our chief of collections, she oversees our exhibits and a curatorial function. We have a chief of museum operations. She oversees our visitor services desk and our technology. Chief of facilities. He oversees our the building maintenance. And thank goodness for him because we've had issues with our air conditioning this summer, and he's been a champ on that. And then a chief of education. And she oversees our school programs, our homeschool programs, our Title I outreach. One of the things that I'm really proud of that we've done is we do a program with local Title I schools where we send a museum educator out to those schools for their after-school program during the school year and, you know, bring out museum artifacts. Yeah, it's really a great outreach that the museum does. It's one of the things I'm really super proud of.
That's cool. There's something about the artifacts, and you mentioned this earlier, how you only build exhibits around things that you have a collection of artifacts for. There is something about being able to see and touch. I'm sure a lot of things you can't actually touch, but just seeing it right there, that this existed a couple hundred years ago or however long ago. Right. And it helps to take you back to the place and it helps give the story more meaning. I think for all ages, not even just for kids, but even for me, you know, sure. When I can see something in front of me.
That's the wonderful thing about our museum, right? So as I mentioned, we have 2.4 million objects in the collection, roughly 6,000 on exhibit at the museum in our two historic houses. And that's what people come to the museum for, right?
Yeah.
They come to the museum to see cool stuff.
Yeah.
Right? And we've got some really amazing pieces. Just for example, we did a top 10 this year for our 250th anniversary. And one of the objects in there, it might not look like much when you see it, but it's really a pretty cool story. So they're basket fragments that came from an archaeological dig from the Hayward Washington House, which the museum owns. And they date to about the 1790s. So almost certainly made by enslaved people. And we've had modern sweetgrass basket makers look at them, and they have said, yeah, the weave in those fragments is the exact same thing that we use in our sweetgrass baskets today.
Wow. Right?
So these are 1790s. You know, this is 100 years after Charleston settled, made by enslaved people, bringing a craft that they brought from Africa. And here you are seeing it, you know, on the streets of Charleston being sold today. I mean, that's amazing.
And, that is amazing.
To be able to come to the museum and see that and learn that kind of story, that really is, that's very fulfilling, you know, as a museum director, and I think really as any museum staff person.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. One of my favorite things with history, I told you, for me, I wasn't much of a history person when I was a kid, and then I really, you know, grew that appreciation as I got older. I like seeing a side-by-side photo for now versus several hundred years ago, mm-hmm. and just kind of compare them and see the changes over time. I think that's really neat.
Yeah, in fact, at our Joseph Manigo House, which was saved by what was then known as the Society for Preservation of Old Dwellings, is now the Preservation Society of Charleston. They helped save the house in the 1920s. We've got some great photos. There was an Esso station right on the corner of where the Manigo House is on Meeting Street. And yeah, to see those photos from the 30s and now to see it in its restored state as it would have looked in the early 19th yeah. century is really, I agree. It's kind of neat to get that perspective. Neat,
right. Esso station. What's an Esso station?
Well, it eventually became Exxon.
Oh,
Eastern,
got it. Okay.
Yeah, Eastern Standard Oil. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wild.
Yeah.
Wild. Yeah, it's stuff like that. Just really neat right. to see. It's wild. What do y'all have lined up for as we transition out of the summer and into the fall?
So really great programs coming up. So we've got part two of our 250th anniversary exhibit is in our Historic Textiles Gallery now. And it features what we've done with this exhibit, we've pulled out some kind of unique objects that you don't normally get to see. One of which is a pew that was made by enslaved people for a church on Edisto Island. It was used by them during the time they were enslaved, but then afterwards when they were free people. So that's on exhibit in that gallery, and that's going to go on permanent exhibit next year. And then Pelagornis sandersi is the world's largest flying bird. Fossils were found out at Charleston Airport back in the 1980s, and we've got parts of the Pelagornis on display. We've got a cast in the Natural History Gallery, but the original fossils are on display.
This is an extinct bird?
Yes, extinct bird. Largest flying bird, had a wingspan about 22 feet. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And largest flying bird to have ever existed. So that's going on. And wow. Then we've got a great event in October it's called Mad Hatter. I did this a few years ago. It's, you know, based on Alice in Wonderland. And we encourage guests to wear whatever hat they want.
Nice.
I think I wore three different hats last time, which was great. one of which was a World War II flying helmet. So any case, that's coming up. And then also in October, we've got our Dill Sanctuary Community Day, which is our wildlife sanctuary on James Island. It's free to the public. And folks can come out and you know, hear about archaeology and hear about natural history of the property.
Wow, very cool. Very cool. So a lot of fun things coming up here.
Yes.
Okay, so we're going to transition into final couple questions where people can find you. Before we do that, a couple rapid fire questions for you, if you're up for it.
I'm always up for it.
We're always up for it? Okay. What is your favorite history book besides the ones that you wrote?
Oh, boy, that's a toughie. I'm just going to go with The Papers of Nathaniel Greene because I can't think of anything else.
Okay. Favorite historical movie?
Ooh, that's going to be a tough one. I would say, I think I'm going to go with Glory, which was based on the Black, you know, 54th Massachusetts
yeah.
Regiment.
Okay.
You know, fought right here in the Charleston area.
Wow, okay. If there were two more that snuck into the top three.
Saving Private Ryan is just so incredibly moving. This is historically themed, is not necessarily historically accurate. And this one of my favorite movies is Last of the Mohicans.
Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah. All right, very nice. Favorite country besides the U.S. that you have an appreciation for their history?
I got to go. I was going to say England, but I would also say Poland as well.
Yeah. Really? Why Poland?
My dad's, he's Ukrainian, but they actually lived in what's modern day Poland. And that poor country has been, you know, invaded by Russia and Germany and everybody, but you know, they've persevered, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I was fortunate enough to visit Italy here earlier this year and in Rome and was fascinated by their history as well, which goes thousands of years back.
Right.
That was a unique experience to see just things that go that are older than Jesus, you know, still standing.
Also, there were two Revolutionary War soldiers from Poland that fought here in South Carolina. That is Kosciuszko. Yep. In fact, Kosciuszko fought in the last battle of the Revolutionary War, which was fought on James Island. And Kazimierz Pulaski, who was killed at the Battle of Savannah, he was here in Charleston the year before. And actually, in the museum is a piece of grape shot, which is a little lead projectile that is supposedly the one that killed Pulaski at the Siege of Savannah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wild.
Now, Georgia Historical Society says they also have the grape shot that killed them, so...
Yeah.
The grape shot was fired in bundles, so it's possible that both of us have it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Okay, last rapid fire. Do you have a favorite history podcast you like to listen to?
I don't offend. You've got me on that one.
Yeah, okay. Hey, fair enough. Okay, let's move into, first of all, if people want to find more information, Carl, about you or about the Charleston Museum, where should they go?
Easiest place is charlestonmuseum.org, and you'll see information about our current exhibits, upcoming exhibits, upcoming programs. Please especially look up our Mad Hatter Party and our Dill Sanctuary Community Day coming up. And then, by all means, follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
Okay, fantastic. All right, last couple of questions. If you could go back in time and give some advice to younger Carl, and just give him maybe a little bit of perspective about what lies ahead, what would you go back and say?
I would say don't worry so much. Everything's going to work out, right?
Yeah.
Leave it in God's hands.
Yeah, that's great advice. Is that advice that you feel like you do better at putting into play now?
I'm not 100% perfect on that, no.
Sure. None of us are.
I've struggled all summer with the air conditioning at the Charleston Museum. So, yeah, there's always something to worry about.
Yeah, you always want to take great care of your air conditioning guy. He's on the quick dial list.
Definitely.
He gets a Christmas card for sure. Yep. Awesome. All right, final question. If you could give one piece of advice, let's say someone who's learning about your story, about the museum, they're inspired to just maybe take a big chance. You know, you left the CPA world to move into this world. It's a big change. If someone's feeling inspired to make a big change like that, maybe they're a little anxious about it, what advice would you give them?
Well, as a young person, you know, you have your whole life ahead of you, right? So, and that was the decision I made. I had worked for a couple of years in accounting, and I went back to get my master's in history. And I said, you know, I'll do this young, when I'm unattached, when I don't have a family. And it worked out. So, you know, take advantage of your young years and you know, follow your dreams.
That's a good time to take risks.
Yes,
absolutely.
It is. Yes, it
absolutely.
Is.
Carl, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming to hang out with us and have a conversation with us. Check out charlestonmuseum.org for more information, and make sure to get out to check out some of their fall exhibits and the Mad Hatter Party.
Thank you, Carl, so much, Jeremy.
Appreciate you.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, y'all, that's a wrap on today's episode. Thanks so much for watching. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure to like or follow or subscribe, whatever platform you're on. Just hit the button to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.
Yep, and please help us grow the channel by sharing it with someone else who might enjoy it as well. Thank you so much for watching, and we'll see you next time.